This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. For the past week and a half, following the chaos in Venezuela has required double vision.
Venezuela's military leaders pledged their support to President Nicolas Maduro today, a day after the U.S. recognized 35-year-old opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president.
There is the authoritarian socialist Maduro, recently reelected in a dubious vote and trying to cling to power. And there is the opposition leader Guaido, the head of the National Assembly, who's used an obscure article of the Venezuelan Constitution also to claim the presidency on the grounds of Maduro's illegitimacy. At least a dozen foreign governments support him.
Guaido maintains that the Constitution allows him to assume power, since the opposition considers Maduro's second mandate illegitimate.
Protesters pouring into the streets aimed at forcing President Nicolas Maduro to step down.
New sanctions will be targeted at Venezuela's oil industry. Donald Trump says no option is off the table, including a military one.
In a country with a collapsed economy, hyperinflation, flagrant human rights abuses, institutional dysfunction, and widespread starvation, the political crisis has added a bizarre twist of uncertainty and danger. And the nation's depleted press corps is at pains to figure it all out. Mariana Zuniga is a freelance journalist based in Caracas, and she says it's exhausting to cover two presidents at once.
It's running all the time. Oh, Maduro is speaking. No, now Guaido is speaking. Now both are speaking at the same time. And being a journalist in Venezuela is very difficult, also for the fact that there's a lot of censorship and a lot of misinformation and a lot of fake news going around. So having to verify everything is exhausting. The more impressive are the local journalists. Because in Venezuela, there are not many independent journals. There are not many independent radio stations. Most things have been taken by the government for a long time. There are a few websites working, but they do a titanic work to try to maintain a whole country, 30 million people informed.
Guaido, we've learned, was a student activist who likes to dance. But beyond that, a total cipher. He's the opposition, but is he the right-wing opposition, the centrist opposition? Is he backed by any powerful constituency? Is this a homegrown coup or a foreign-supported one? Is it a coup at all? In short, Mariana, what the hell is going on?
That's a good question. I don't know if you could help me understand as well. Until very recent, both inside and outside the country, many people didn't know who Juan Guaido was. He's a lawmaker that won the position in the National Assembly in 2015. He participated in the student movement in 2007. We just knew that on January 5th, he was named the leader of the National Assembly, which is the only institution that is led by the opposition in Venezuela. And for many people, that meant something.
Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, came to power in reaction to what the voters believed was an oppressive, incompetent, corrupt, right-wing government. Then they learned what corrupt, oppressive, and incompetent really were with Chavez and Maduro. Are there any hints about whether Guaido can actually govern? Has he been open in press conferences and responsive and articulate? Has he even articulated a set of policies to give you an idea of what may be to come should this change in power stand?
For a very long time, the opposition leader's plan has always been, yeah, let's take Maduro out, without saying what they will change in the country, what they will do. He has expressed, this man, Juan Guaido, many policies that could indicate that they want a recuperation of the country, that they want to fix the economy at least. They are thinking about bringing humanitarian aid into the country, which is very important. People in Venezuela have been dying the last years because lacking of food or because of the scarcity of medicines. They are also thinking about recuperating PDVSA, the state-owned company, which is practically broken, which will be very difficult for them. But the fact that they are not thinking about privatizing is something that indicates that they are not going just the opposite direction. They are also trying to fix or stop immediately, they haven't said how, inflation. And that's another nightmare for Venezuelans, because having bolivars in your hands feel like having chocolate in a sunny day. It feels like your money is melting, losing value all the time. So they have expressed their intentions of changing something.
Around the world, the news media as an industry is in free fall. Venezuela's economy is in an even greater state of collapse. And then there's the censorship of the Maduro regime. What kind of journalism do Venezuelans have access to? Is there anything out there besides state media?
Besides state media and television, there's nothing, actually. There are not many newspapers, and one of the biggest newspapers in Venezuela, El Nacional, on December had to stop printing the newspaper because they didn't have enough resources to import the paper to the country. So now they are just online. But they are also blocked constantly by the government. Journalists have to become like really inventive. For example, there's this initiative of journalists that they jump into buses. The initiative is called Bus TV. They put some kind of cartoon TV frame around their faces, and they start reading the news, the most important things that happened that day in the country.
That's hilarious and horrifying.
But really, at the same time, it's really creative. Most people don't have access to internet. They don't have a smartphone to read Twitter. Crisis makes you inventive. And that's a really good way in which journalists can advance and change as well.
What about internet access to the outside world? Is it blocked by Maduro? And can people even afford broadband to begin with?
I mean, this is not China. There are some websites, especially news sites, that have been blocked by the government. They are not blocked every day, but sometimes it won't be easy to access, maybe for weeks or for days. In terms of internet, there are some private companies that you can hire, and they don't work very well in Venezuela. But there's also a company, CanTV, which is the national one, that is subsidized by the government. So in theory, it's very cheap, but it works very bad.
I don't even know if you know this. We're speaking on Thursday. As of this morning, according to Agence France-Presse, the authorities there have detained 5 foreign journalists who've been covering the Maduro-Guaido standoff, and deported 2 others. You report for foreign news organizations. Is this a dangerous time for journalists in Venezuela? Is it an especially dangerous time for you?
Yeah, the fact that somebody can arrive, like happened to the guys from the news agency EFE, to your hotel room with guns and telling you, please, sir, come with us, and put you in one of the most horrible political prisons in the country and maybe in the region, that's scary. Of course I'm scared. But that won't prevent me from doing my job. As a Venezuelan, I feel that I have an advantage because at least they can't deport me. As a Venezuelan, I feel also very proud to be able to explain, even though it's very difficult, to others what, as you said, what the hell is happening in Venezuela, because it's really complicated. But I feel that in some way I'm making history here with my colleagues. It's really scary, but it's really exciting at the same time.
Well, Mariana, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mariana Zuniga is a freelance reporter based in Caracas, Venezuela. Coming up, we're obsessed with people from Latin America coming toward our border. Latin America has learned to be wary of the U.S. venturing there. This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
I got my potato.
On Radiolab.
And I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. When Juan Guaido took the oath of office as would-be interim president of Venezuela last week, he held a copy of the Venezuelan Constitution adorned with a portrait of Simón Bolívar. Known as El Libertador, the Liberator, Bolívar had a vision of a united South America.
Levantemos la mano derecha.
When former President Hugo Chávez was in power, he renamed the country the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela and sang on television after exhuming Bolívar's remains.
Simón Bolívar, Simón, caraqueño americano.
In high school history textbooks, Bolívar is usually referred to as the George Washington of Latin America, which might be selling him short. He freed no fewer than 6 countries from the oppression of Spanish colonial rule in the early 19th century, and for good measure, he worked to abolish slavery decades before we did.
Bolivar's military action lasted more than twice as long as North America's.
Marie Arana is the author of Bolivar, American Liberator. This is from her TED Talk.
The territory that he covered was 7 times as large and spanned an astonishing geographic diversity, from crocodile-infested jungles to the snow-capped Andes. Moreover, Bolivar's war could not have been won without the aid of Black and Indian troops. His success in rallying Blacks and Indians to his cause marked the turning point of the revolution.
Bolivar was a Caracas-born aristocrat, educated in Europe and fluent in the teachings of the Enlightenment. He was also an exemplar both of political vision and of paradox. For instance, he was disgusted by slavery in the U.S. and dismissive about fixation on race, but also highly wary of surrendering too much political power to the indigenous and Black majority, for fear of having popular revolutions topple his revolutions. He gave himself the title Liberator and Dictator, which is evidence as good as any that his legacy is ambiguous, even for those who now claim to represent it. Miguel Tinker Salas is a Venezuelan historian and professor at Pomona College. He says there are 2 Bolivars, the elite statesman and the man of the people.
He's a powerful figure that is brought back into the forefront by the latter part of the 19th century as a symbolic figure, unfortunately as the elite Bolívar, as the statesman Bolívar, to help consolidate the nation, searching for national symbols. And that's the role he began to play. That official Bolívar always coexisted side by side with another Bolívar, a popular Bolívar, a Bolívar that was identified by the social movements, by people of color, by others who looked in his writings about empire and about the U.S.'s efforts at reconquering Latin America. So these two Bolívars coexisted in Venezuela throughout the 20th century. The elites promoting one vision of this statesman Bolívar and the other captured in music and song and poetry as a potent symbol for political change.
The invocation of Bolívar by various constituencies reminds me a little bit of scripture. Depending on your worldview, your religious philosophy, you can make a given passage stand for your views, or somebody can make an adjacent passage stand for the opposite.
Yeah, no doubt. I've always said that quoting Bolívar tells us more about the person that is quoting Bolívar than it does about Bolívar. He cannot be simplified as a radical, as a democrat, as a dictator, as a caudillo, military strongman. He is a very complex figure. He was complex on questions of race. He wanted to incorporate people of color, but then he also tried a commander who rejected one of his orders and had him executed as a message to Afro-Venezuelans about any potential race-based rebellion. So here's a controversial figure.
Let's not move past that execution too quickly, because it seemed to stand for his general misgivings about democracy, did it not? That he was concerned that the ethnic majorities of Latin America, given too much power, could lead still more revolutions against the governing elites.
Haiti is in the background of all the independence leaders in Latin America. They saw what happened with the oppression of slaves and the oppression of people of color, and then their rebellion against the French colonial rule, one of the most profitable colonies in all of the Caribbean. So that's always in the background. But he's also a bit worried about how this democracy is going to take root. After all, there is nothing to unify the country. The country had been a colony. It had not been a country. There wasn't national symbols. There wasn't even loyalty to a capital city. As soon as Caracas declares independence, the other provinces are pulling in the opposite direction, since there's very little faith that a concept such as democracy, which had not been practiced in Venezuela or any other colonial entity, can somehow bring this together. So he made a statement that trying to promote democracy was akin to plowing the ocean in Latin America.
So he is una paradoja. That's me speaking Spanish.
Yes. He is a paradox, but whose vision was interpreted as an unfinished vision for Latin America and for Venezuela. And that's where you have Hugo Chavez coming into the picture, to take that other Bolívar, that other image, and to promote his project as part of Bolívar's unfinished business.
You spoke of Bolívar as a visionary. Well, you can say that again. He really hearted George Washington, and George Washington really hearted him. But Bolívar was also quoted as saying about the United States that it, quote, appeared destined to plague Latin America with misery in the name of liberty, which is about as dead on as can be.
And that quote is adorned on walls throughout Latin America and especially in Venezuela. Not everyone reads Bolívar, but everyone knows anecdotally some of his sayings, some of his proclamations, some of his ideals. So you have the larger symbolic Bolívar as the shadow over much of this process. One that, again, differences have been drawn between what was the elite Bolívar and how he was represented and the people's Bolívar or the popular Bolívar. And there's a very interesting song in Venezuela by a singer named Ali Primera. It's called Canción Bolivariana, the Bolivarian song, in which Bolívar is having a conversation with a young boy. And Bolívar says, look, the elites are going to my grave to pay homage to me. And the young boy says, no, Bolívar.
Asegurarse de que estés bien muerto, libertador. Bien muerto.
They're going to make sure you're dead, so that you do not return.
Le saltaba el corazón por lo que estaba escuchando.
He's been dead for about 185 years. He has not rested in peace. He had been exhumed.
Well, he doesn't die in Venezuela. He's exiled to Colombia. So it takes quite some time to bring his bones back to Venezuela. They're brought back and they're put in a tomb with other family bones. In 1945, when there's a democratic interregnum in Venezuela, the government convenes a committee to determine the bones of Bolívar and to actually unearth the casket, open it, and examine it. And there's actually a convocation sent to the other Bolivarian republics of Latin America to tell them this is happening.
And then, as mentioned in the introduction, in 2010, Chavez did it too.
Chavez argued that it was an effort to develop a more realistic image of Bolívar by digital imaging and also to determine if Bolívar had been poisoned, because there was always this mythology that Bolívar had been poisoned by his enemies. In the end, after the casket had been opened and the imaging done, what emerged was a much swarthier image of Bolívar that then was used to adorn government buildings throughout Venezuela. It's interesting because for many in the poor sectors of Venezuela, while the elites and others may have been mocking the opening of the casket, others actually, and I saw them cry. It was the first time they had seen in human form the remains of El Libertador, the liberator.
The Venezuelan author Alberto Barrera wrote a column in the New York Times in Spanish, observing that far from unifying Venezuela, the cult, as he phrased it, of Simón Bolívar now is tearing the country apart. Is he more divisive at this point than unifying?
It's interesting you would raise that. I would have said for the opposition, he is divisive because of the Chavez appropriation of Bolívar. And in fact, that article by Tarre cites several historians have written essays as to why they are not Bolivarian. Except that now with Juan Guaido, we have him using the symbol of Bolívar on the constitution that he swore his self-proclaimed presidency. What is he attempting to do? I don't think that appeals the same way to the middle class and upper classes who may have supported him. Was he making an effort to reach other classes? It's unclear at this point, but it's obvious that he was making use of that symbol. In the past, Bolívar would have been seen as appropriated by the Chavistas and not promoted. When the National Assembly is taken by the opposition in 2015 and they are inaugurated in 2016, one of the first things they do is take down the images of Chavez and of Bolívar, so that they were trying to, quote unquote, cleanse the space of these previous influences.
I have one final question for you. What would you do? How would you mediate this situation where two men and two factions are claiming the presidency?
I would start by going to the meeting on February 7th that Mexico and Uruguay have convened in Montevideo, because the only solution here is to find some level of negotiated, mediated solution. The real issue here is the social fabric in Venezuela. No matter who is in power, whether it's the opposition and its many factions, or whether it's the Chavistas and their many factions. Because the reality is, unless there's some kind of consensus on what is going to happen next and how both sides respect the political decision that is made, the reality is we'll be back to square one tomorrow. And it'll repeat and repeat, because neither the Chavistas nor the opposition are going away.
Miguel, many thanks.
Thank you.
Miguel Tinker Salas is a Venezuelan historian and professor at Pomona College, author of Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. Amid all the confusion surrounding the power struggle in Venezuela, National Security Advisor John Bolton raised a yellow warning flag about American military intervention. Or anyway, a yellow legal pad, which he carried into a White House press briefing, conspicuously displaying a single provocative notation.
Bolton was holding a notepad with the words 5,000 troops to Colombia, clearly visible. The White House would only say that all options are on the table.
When it comes to American intervention in Latin America, history tells us, all options are always on the table. Whether through direct military action or CIA mischief, the United States has variously propped up, brought down, or attempted to bring down regimes in Cuba, Puerto Rico, Mexico, Honduras, Nicaragua, Brazil, the Dominican Republic, Argentina, Haiti, Chile, Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Panama, Peru, Grenada, and Uruguay, just about every country in this hemisphere. According to Stephen Kinzer, author of Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, U.S.-backed coups and invasions tend to follow three steps.
The first thing that happens is that that country makes some kind of a problem for an American corporate interest. It tries to impose taxes, or it limits the amount of land they can own, or it tries to subject them to local labor laws, and that company then complains to the U.S. government. That's phase one. Then, inside the American political process, the motive changes, it morphs. Then we decide if country X is bothering an American company, it must mean that that country is an enemy of ours. So we're intervening for strategic reasons. That's phase two. And then phase three comes when it's time for us to explain why we did it, to justify it. Then we forget both of those motivations. We say, oh, it was another reason, and that was we did it to protect the poor suffering masses in that country who are being brutalized. This is something that always works with Americans. We are a very compassionate people. Our leaders know this about us.
The mother of all such interventions, you believe, was Guatemala.
So what happened in Guatemala in 1954 was a classic archetype of the way we operate and what angers us. The Guatemalan government finally, in the late 40s and early 1950s, became democratic. The great injustice at that time in Guatemala was that although large numbers of people were living on the edges of starvation, United Fruit Company owned hundreds of thousands of acres that it didn't use. So under the Arbenz government in Guatemala in the early 1950s, Congress passed a land reform law that required large landowners, principally United Fruit, to sell their unused land to the government, which would then cut it up and divide it up for peasant families. The outrage that United Fruit felt coursed through the White House and led us to conclude that Guatemala must be a hostile enemy. And that led us into the intervention, which overthrew the only democracy Guatemala's ever known in 1954. Look back at the results. A civil war began a few years later, and that civil war lasted for 30 years.
It's sickening on the face of it, more sickening still in the fact that the U.S. press, the watchdogs of our government, were leading the cheers.
The United Fruit Company hired a very skilled propagandist, Edward Bernays, the father of public relations, to persuade Americans that Guatemala was their enemy. They started producing films like one called Why the Kremlin Hates Bananas.
There is a very special reason why they must hate bananas in Moscow. United Fruit has put to useful production hundreds of thousands of acres of otherwise unproductive tropical lands.
Americans would slowly come to believe this fiction that some evil communist repressive regime had seized Guatemala and had proven its evil nature by bothering the United Fruit Company. They would bring journalists in groups down to Guatemala, and these journalists would just show up at wherever United Fruit wanted to take them, write down what the executive said, and then go back home and report this as reality. The few people who tried to write that actually land reform was an urgent necessity and people were starving in Guatemala were marginalized, and their reports were never allowed to reach the American people. It was one of the most shameful episodes in the history of the press until we get up to the modern day.
And with ongoing consequences in the hemisphere, it was used as an example by the likes of Fidel Castro and other revolutionaries in the ensuing decades as to American imperialism.
So during the period when Arbenz was in power in Guatemala in the early 1950s, lots of progressive activists from all over Latin America were fascinated with what was happening in Guatemala. They wanted to go and see, how does land reform work? How does labor organizing work? One of those young idealists who came to Guatemala was Che Guevara. He was there and he witnessed the coup. After the coup, he met Fidel Castro. Che told him in the end, here's the central lesson we should learn from Guatemala. It is not possible in Latin America to impose a serious social reform program under the auspices of a democracy. Democracies are open societies. The CIA will use that openness, come in and crush you. So if we ever take power in Cuba, we have to crush all opposition. We cannot allow a free press. We cannot allow free speech. That became not only the template for Cuba, but the ideal, because they saw the example of what the United States had done in Guatemala.
Let's move ahead to some more recent history, 2009 and Honduras.
So in 2009, we had a president in Honduras who we didn't like, and the reason was he was friendly with Hugo Chavez, the Venezuelan leader who we took as kind of the new Castro and the great enemy that we faced in Latin America. So we had him in our sights. And in the middle of the night, military officers crashed into his house, dragged him out in his pajamas, and put him on a plane and sent him out of the country. We cheered. And what has happened since then? The government has become repressive. It has been reelected despite a constitutional prohibition on reelection. It has become one of the highest murder rate countries in the world. And the so-called caravans that are coming through Mexico towards our border are made up largely of Hondurans. This is not unrelated to our intervention there.
And this intervention is not at the hands of the Eisenhower administration, not of the Ronald Reagan administration. It was the Obama administration, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
As President Obama said today, we have taken this position because we respect the universal principle that people should choose their own leaders, whether they are leaders we agree with or not.
Hillary Clinton applauded the coup. In her memoir, she wrote a great paragraph about what a wonderful thing it was and how we just allowed the Hondurans to choose their own fate. As it started to go really bad, I did notice that in the paperback edition of Hillary Clinton's memoir, she's taken out that paragraph.
How does the Venezuela situation fit into your three-stage template?
First of all, I'm quite surprised and in some ways impressed to see that our national security advisor, Mr. Bolton, announced the other day that we are interested in taking control of the oil in Venezuela.
We're in conversation with major American companies now that are either in Venezuela or in the case of Citgo here in the United States. It'll make a big difference to the United States economically if we could have American oil companies really.
Now, you're not supposed to say that. The Americans are supposed to keep that a secret and say, we're only doing it to help the starving Venezuelans. But if it's going to be a military intervention, this has to be debated in Congress. We don't do this anymore, but our Constitution requires it.
Oh, and just for a little icing on top, the Trump administration has brought in Ronald Reagan's old conquistador, Elliot Abrams, because I suppose Hernan Cortez was unavailable. What are we supposed to make of this development?
The appointment of Elliot Abrams is truly mind-boggling, especially for us old fogies that remember the 1980s. So back then, I was a New York Times correspondent in Central America. Elliot Abrams was a principal perpetrator of U.S. policy in Central America. He was a main supporter of the Contra Project in Nicaragua. That also entailed the intense militarization of Honduras. So we're not just taking the mentality of the interventionist 1980s in Central America and bringing it back to life. We're actually bringing back the actual person that did it. How do you think this looks to people in Venezuela and the rest of Latin America?
You and I have previously discussed on this very show the media's fascination with war and the kind of bellicose jingoism that we as an institution have embraced over the decades to drag the country into conflict, beginning with Cuba a century ago. What is that history, and what must we take care of as the press not to get caught doing here?
Back in 1898, when William Randolph Hearst was inventing the concept of yellow journalism, he understood a principle that the press still understands today. And that is, if you want to get people to tune in every day or buy every day, What you really need is a running story, a story that goes on and on. The best running story of all is a war. The American involvement in the Spanish-American War was largely whipped up with stories about the evil brutalities being perpetrated in Cuba, many of which were written by reporters in New York who had never even been to Cuba. If you move that up to the present day, I think you see something of the same thing, but there's a more sophisticated patina to it. In some ways, it's even more pernicious. In the American press, there's a sense among many, many editors and reporters that the press's role is to explain to people why it's important that we follow the policies our president has enunciated. That's not what the press is for. We are not supposed to be just stenographers writing down what leaders say and then sending it off to the American people. We're supposed to be asking questions. Wait a minute. Is this really as big a danger as we say? Is everything they say really true? Is it really so sure we're going to succeed? But our press doesn't do that because that's not what the government in Washington wants them to do. And once you rebel against that paradigm, you become considered what John McCain called a wacko bird, someone who's completely off the consensus. And the power of the Washington consensus to pull people into it is truly awesome and impressive.
So we're speaking Wednesday, this just in. It turns out that the New York Times published an op-ed by Guaido calling on the democracies of the world to support his claim to the presidency, because that's the only way they're going to get out of the hell that Venezuela's in now.
Well, congratulations to the New York Times. I hate the fact that most of the Democratic Party and most of the Republican Party is in this war consensus. I hate the fact that most of the think tanks in Washington are in this consensus. But as a person who has spent his life in the press, what I hate the most is that the press has been drawn into this. If you look at the commentary pages of all major American newspapers, it's so monochromatic. It goes between neocons and liberal interventionists. There is no fundamental questioning of the premises on which these interventions are launched. And that puts us back in a position where the press is really almost as shameful as it was in its performance way back in the Spanish-American War in 1898.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Always good to be with you.
Stephen Kinzer is a professor of international relations at Brown University. Coming up, in China, making cultural suppression look like summer camp. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. For 2.5 years, in the Xinjiang province of far northwest China, the government has been building a network of internment camps, fenced in and policed from guard towers.
Evidence is growing that up to 1 million Muslim Uyghurs are being held by Chinese authorities in so-called re-education camps.
6 Uyghur employees of Radio Free Asia say their relatives back in Xinjiang have disappeared in the last year.
3 of my brothers and 2 of my sisters are missing. I lost contact with my mom.
The Uyghurs have been taken away, not just to suppress any nascent separatist inclinations, but to eradicate their culture, perceived, like Buddhist Tibet, to be a threat to the country's Han Chinese majority. On top of trying to reshape an entire people's way of life, the Communist Party is attempting to shape the world's perception of what is taking place, with the sometimes careless help of Western media. Historian Ryan Thumb has studied Uyghur culture for 20 years and written about the Chinese government's activities. He's a senior research fellow at the University of Nottingham and author of The Sacred Roots of Uyghur History. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
What is it about them that so puts the Communist Party on edge?
The overarching reason that the Chinese authorities have most frequently given is that these are people in danger of extremist mindsets. They're in danger of picking up international terrorist ideologies that will lead them to engage in acts of violent resistance against the state. The great irony here is that the things they're calling extremism are often incredibly minor. For example, giving up smoking, not selling alcohol at your convenience store, not greeting officials on the street, not watching government television, possessing any number of books, including really innocuous novels. It's actually quite difficult to avoid doing something that the government would call extremist.
Now, pretty alarmingly, you say that the Chinese propaganda push to spin the story of the Uyghur camps has been successful. Why do you think it's working?
The way in which it's working most effectively is that it has injected images created by the Chinese state of camps that have been altered and dressed up specifically for foreign audiences, filled with people who are chosen for these films and who are trained to give certain kinds of answers.
After discussing this with my family, I applied to come here voluntarily.
Most of the students are not proficient in Chinese. They are easily instigated and coerced by terrorist and extremist ideologies.
If I had not come here to study, maybe I would have followed those religious extremists and walked down the path of crime.
They have managed to inject those images into our media environment. They appear in quite a number of video segments, including one by CNN International.
Reporters witness people singing, learning Mandarin in the presence of government officials.
And stills from these videos are often placed in newspaper articles and online news sources. That's particularly powerful because we don't have any images of people in the camps that have been taken by independent media, because the Chinese state is extraordinarily careful not to allow journalists into, or even if they can help it, near these camps. So if you want an image, you're basically stuck with what the Chinese government gives you, and the ones that they've most recently passed out are incredibly deceptive.
It's particularly chilling that these same propaganda techniques were used by the Nazis in the 30s and 40s.
If you look at the very famous film, Theresienstadt, the model camp slash ghetto that the Nazis presented to the world and gave people tours of, there are some very similar images of people engaged in exercise or dance, calisthenics, images of people listening to lectures, images of people working at sewing machines, which look like the labor section of the Chinese propaganda footage. So there's a resonance in the fact that when the Nazis offered this sort of fake camp to the world, a lot of newspapers ran with it and published those images and sort of took the bait. And to a certain extent, we're seeing that again today.
It becomes a difficult decision for photo editors because even the state-supplied Potemkin Village versions of internment camp reality are pretty horrifying and call attention to the stories that are beneath, which are more horrifying still, but they kind of elide over the truth at the same time. So, you know, what is a news organization to do?
Well, there are some other options. I mean, you know, there are many dozens of these camps that have been identified on Google Earth. This imagery has been quite powerful, I think. It doesn't include humans, which is something that media outlets like to have in an image. But I think what they tell you is exactly the truth about our state of knowledge of this, which is we don't know what's happening inside of them. One of the other sets of images we have comes from local Xinjiang government that was publishing images for internal audiences before there was an international awareness of what was going on. And those images tend to emphasize, instead of these people are actually having a good time, they're emphasizing, we have the Uyghurs under control. Look at the regimented rows. Look at the enormous number of police in what appears to be SWAT clothing guarding them as they sit and listen to lectures. Look at the tall fences that they're in. And so we have these images now. One of the problems with those images is that they are low resolution. And some outlets have run with these. There was the cover of the New York Review of Books, for example, used one of these images.
It's not just the propaganda photos. You are seeing the press make other mistakes that obscure the reality. What are they?
One that's rare but has appeared in a couple of places is the use of the Chinese government's own language. I'm thinking in particular of a story about a tour of these dressed-up camps that was given to journalists, in which the author of the piece sometimes called them internment camps and then sometimes slipped into the Chinese government's terminology, which is right now that they're vocational training centers. They used to call them transformation education centers, and before that they called them de-extremification centers. But we see sometimes journalists picking up that terminology. A Wall Street Journal story even called them residents at one point.
Residents. That's just one short step away from guests.
Yeah, right. Another thing that's happening is that a lot of times a news outlet will, I think what they want to do is provide an image that shows that Uyghurs are Muslims. And so what they end up doing is choosing an image that has, for example, a Uyghur person praying in public or a woman with a veil. Those common stereotypes of what it means to be a Muslim are precisely the kinds of activities that the Chinese state has been cracking down on. So if you see a picture of a Muslim praying in public in Xinjiang in a newspaper story about this, it's probably going to be a stock photo from 3 or 4 years ago when in some places it was still possible to pray in public. But it's highly unlikely that anyone would do that these days. And this is, again, a problem of access. You know, when the police are erasing photos off of cameras every time the journalists go out there, it's very hard to get images. And so they have to rely on these older photos.
But that's not the only mechanism for reporting on what's going on in these camps. The Atlantic reported on people like you, scholars, and citizen journalists who are gathering evidence that even the official press simply has no access to. Can you tell me more?
Aside from the excellent journalists at Radio Free Asia's Uyghur service, there are pretty much no Uyghur-speaking journalists outside of China. So some scholars who do speak Uyghur and do have a long experience in the region have made visits recently to write about what's going on there. And then we also have examples of people finding very clever ways to dig up evidence from the Chinese state itself. Probably the most important study that was done was by a scholar named Adrian Zenz from Germany, who looked at the Chinese government's advertisements asking for construction companies to submit bids to build these things. That was what really brought this issue to wide-scale attention.
So we know that the government is looking for construction of a 500,000 square foot facility with wire fences and guard towers.
Yes. And enterprising journalists have also jumped on to this tactic. AFP produced an amazing story from over 1,000 Chinese government documents, which documented purchasing orders for cattle prods, for batons, handcuffs, something called wolf's teeth, which is apparently a spiked club. So these have been really important to showing what the real nature of these camps is.
In spite of your work, and in spite of some of the great journalism, the world does not seem to be up in arms about the plight of the Uyghurs. Where is the outrage?
The number one reason for the shortage of outrage is the economic entanglement that almost every country on the planet has with China. It's exacerbated by the fact that, at least until recently, very few people had ever heard of the Uyghurs. It's quite difficult to get people to care about a group of humans they didn't even know exists. And I think another thing that for a while made this difficult to communicate to people is that the Chinese state has been ratcheting up controls on Uyghur movement, Uyghur expression, Uyghur religious practice for 30 years now. It's been a steady increase of controls. And since 2009, if you visited the place, it looked like it's under a military occupation with caravans of military vehicles parading around the towns, checkpoints everywhere. So I think initially a lot of news outlets were skeptical that something was really dramatically different.
You've been studying the Uyghurs for at least 20 years. And I must assume that many of the people you know have been caught up in this network of internment. What has become of your friends?
I don't have very good solid news for most of them. There's one who's definitely confirmed to be gone. The others, I haven't heard from. Quite a lot of my friends' online presence disappeared. You never know when somebody's social media account goes dark, whether it's because they've been taken away or because they're protecting themselves. Because if you have contacts with foreigners, that's one of the reasons that people get sent away.
There was in one of your pieces a reference to someone actually leaving custody, and the guard said something quite menacing.
They threatened that if you speak up, your parents are here, and so are we.
Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your attention to this issue.
Ryan Thumb is a senior research fellow at the University of Nottingham and author of The Sacred Roots of Uyghur History. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Lowinger, Leia Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Oster Chattavetti. We had more help from Zandra Ellen and Alice Maiden, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.